and raised in Waukesha. He did his first hunting and fishing right here. Now he hunts the world and cooks it up deliciously, featured as the Midwestern host of The Fowl Life on the Outdoor Channel. Joe Clayfish was raised in the Shaw. A couple extra pounds never really
hurt. Cause a country boy. Good evening, Wisconsin. Joel Clayfish joining you live from the Fishbowl in downtown Waukesha, 217 Wisconsin Avenue. Swing by, say hey. This is Raised in the Shaw with Joel Clayfish. Of course, I was raised in the Shaw, a couple of blocks away at Waukesha Memorial Hospital. And matter of fact, I want to say that I was just over there. My father-in-law had a procedure that went very well, and I spent the last couple of days over there, and what a great team they have at Waukesha Memorial Hospital. We are in the bowels of summer, ladies and gentlemen, in the city of Waukesha, Wisconsin. And what that means is one day it can be 50 degrees out, and the next day it can be 95 with 100% humidity. And you know, the audience of this show in particular are number one fans, the Kennedy clan, Dan and Robin Kennedy and their kids out in Oconomowoc. I know they listen every week, so I'm going to give them a shout out. If you prove to me that you listen every week, you'll get a shout out too. But the regular fans of the show are really into hunting, fishing, and the outdoor sports in the state of Wisconsin. And there really is no better place in the country, in the world, frankly, to have more of a variety of outdoor activities to participate in. But if you know me, you know that I absolutely love to throw and even try to catch curveballs some days. And what that means is that we get a variety of folks on this show. We had Tony Goff, you know, a huge influence in the music scene in the city of Waukesha in the state of Wisconsin. We had Greg Wansnyder on the show. And we're going to divert a little bit from the outdoor topic, a little bit, because our guest today is a friend of mine who's been a friend for nearly three and a half decades. If you can even imagine that, I've known him for three and a half decades, and I'd like to say we've been friends that whole time. And the way we got to know each other is fascinating, and this man is fascinating. He's an icon in Milwaukee in the state of Wisconsin, and has really not only influenced the way we look at history and the history of the state of Wisconsin, but with such a personal touch and grace that I'm so excited and honored to have him on the show this week. His name is Claiborne Benson, and I first met Claiborne Benson, you know, 30 plus years ago in television news. He was a photojournalist over at Channel 4 WTMJ. I was a brand new young reporter over at WISN 12. And one of the beauties of Clay and my friendship is that every time we've seen each other in the past 30 years, we have a warm greeting for each other. And I think each of us loves to just catch up on what the other person's been doing because our lives have changed so much. And Claiborne Benson is a man who never stops learning and never stops passing his knowledge on to all. And now he is the executive director of the Wisconsin Black Historical Society. And Claiborne, how fantastic to see you, as it always is. And I look across this table and think, you're the same man I met 30 years ago. You haven't aged a day. But what a blessing to have you with us, and what amazing work you've been doing.
The honor is mine. I am delighted to be here. And you know something? You are conservative, and I'm a liberal. Isn't that something?
Oh, no. Stop the train, everybody. How on earth is that even possible for us to be friends?
And we are friends. There's no question about it whatsoever. And I love you. I love what you do. I'm even beginning to like your wife. And I may even consider voting
for you. Well, I appreciate that, and every once in a while I think she likes me.
Well, that's good, and she's working her butt off as she travels the state and trying to convince people how important her work is, and so
that's no
we're going to support her very much so.
Well, appreciate that very much, and you hit on something that I do kind of think is important to talk about right off the bat at the beginning of the show, and that is you and I have different philosophies, different political philosophies.
We do.
And you and I also both believe that that is never a reason to not have a friendship endure or not, so. Start a new friendship.
I like Mr. Clayfish very much. So I line that name with my name, Clayborne.
Clayfish.
So you are my brother. How could I not like you?
I'll take it any day of the week, although I'll say Clayborne Benson is much more of a TV and radio name than Joel Clayfish. So you had, let's start kind of at the beginning. You were one of you were a very, very highly respected photojournalist.
Thank
at
you.
Channel 12, award winning, several
award winning. Thank you. Many awards, yes.
Yeah, many
you.
Awards through the ages.
I don't know. They're all in the closet somewhere.
Mine are in a box in the basement. I know.
They matter none.
Right.
What matters is what you're about to do and do a good job at that future, whatever it is that you do. So, yeah, my journey through life has been fantastic, and I love every minute of my experiences that I've encountered, as well as the people that I met along the way.
What led you into TV in the first place?
I was always interested in photography, and I went to school, and I remember in my senior year going to the telephone booth and calling the Journal Sentinel and said, I'd like to have a job at their Journal Sentinel. And they said, you need a bachelor's degree. Boy, get out of here. I said, are you kidding me? I'm going to get this J-O-B. I'm going to get it. And I got it. I got it within 6 months of that. Because they were just pushing
it.
Me to the side and said, hey, I got an internship first and went to MATC and worked for TMJ for 13 hours a week at $2 an hour. That's what I worked for.
Isn't that something?
Went away for the Army, did my bid in the Army, and they held my job for me when I got back where I got a full-time job working at TMJ and did that for 39 years of my life. Yes, I loved it, every minute of it. Traveled the entire world, met all sorts of people, and I grew up doing it. I learned so much. I learned how the system works through that job as a news cameraman.
And, you know, I spent 10 years in television news, and television news really shapes a person.
It does.
Because you not only do you have to show everybody an intricate story in a minute and a half. And I mean, and it started when you started probably longer. When I started, two and a half minutes boiled down to 50 seconds by the time I left in that 10 years.
I used to do, I apologize for
interrupting. No, go.
But I used to do little vignettes, as I say. So Thanksgiving, people not receiving gifts during Christmas and what that feel like, what it was like to be a black person. This is the 1970s and such. My rebellious spirit to tell the public the uniqueness of African Americans on air, and they would let me do it.
Mm-hmm.
They would let me put it together and give them the tape, and they would air it. And it stood by itself, which was quite unusual. They would never do that today at any of the stations.
They don't have time for it. A lot of it is, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. And since there is some sense of sensationalism. But you come from the age of storytelling, real storytelling.
Yeah.
And you were always, you know, you were kind of a quiet person to first encounter. And I think that was maybe you were feeling things out at first when I first met
you. Maybe I was feeling myself out. I don't know.
But
I was in a quest to learn and get to know folks. I mean, I never ignored people. I was always had a perspective of my environment, including people around me, as I did various things. I remember, and this is a sidestep, but I remember going to a baseball game, and the governor of Wisconsin came over. Now, I'm a 18-year-old kid with a sweaty T-shirt after running.
Who was it? Was it Dreyfus, maybe?
No,
Lucy?
This is before Lucy. I think Thompson. No, it wasn't Thompson. I don't remember, but I know he came over and he actually put his arms around me in front of 35,000 people. Now, what was that about? I can't imagine that, but he did. I'm all sweaty and I got my camera equipment. I'm ready to shoot this news story on the mound in front of 35 people. Why did he do that? But he did.
Oh, and that made an impression on you.
I still remember it.
Yeah, there were times in television news that are burned in my memory in my mind that there were moments that would catch you off guard. You would unknowingly, when you started that day, be sitting with the mom who lost a child that day lost a child the day before and in a potentially violent act. And you're all of a sudden, I remember as a reporter and with the photographer there, and the photographer tells the story, the visual medium tells the story as much as words, if not more, more often more.
He's sitting there crying. In my case, I'm sitting there feeling the emotion of that house. You're talking, I, in my mind, as you're telling that story, I'm seeing this house on fire. Just, and everything that these people have is in this house. And two or three of their kids are dead. I'm out here expecting to tell the story visually, and tears are just running out of my eyes.
There are moments like that that changed me forever, because we had insight so often into places we didn't even deserve to be, were.
We do.
And I do count that as one of God's blessings in my life, to be able to have experienced what we experienced. And, you know, for you, a young African-American man at a time in the state's history.
You tell them I was black. I don't know if they wanted to know that I was
you
black.
You already said that.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. We're still friends. Go ahead with your story. I'm sorry.
I was going to ask you. You were, you know, you started in the industry at a time where there was...
I was the first to be hired at WTMJ Television, first cameraman and first in the news department to be hired at WTMJ Television. Yes. And because people picketed, I'm sorry to interrupt you, because people picketed out front of the WTMJ Television, Ruben Harpo, a couple other people actually picketed in front of TMJ, demanding that there be something that they hire an African American in those places. Yes, that was significant to me.
You were a groundbreaker. There's no question about it, and you continue to be a groundbreaker. And see how fast this show goes. We're already into the first break, and when we come back, we've got Milwaukee and Wisconsin icon Claiborne Benson with us, and we're going to explore his life a little bit more when we come back. You're listening to Raised in the Shaw with Joel Clayfish. We'll be right back on 540 AM.
I love my country.
Are we okay?
I love my guns.
Great.
Good.
I love my family.
Great radio.
Good. I love the way it is now. Good. And anybody that tries to change it,
and I know it's
in- has to come through me. That should be all of our attitude.
I'm sorry.
This is America, and a country boy's good enough for me, son.
Well, That was my life.
Matt Flynn Direct airs weekdays from 6 to 8 a.m.
Cut you down.
The Shaw 101 FM, your fix for progressive talk. From Muskego to Pewaukee, always streaming at waukradio.com.
Isn't that something?
Yep.
Did you ever meet him?
Yes, I have.
Welcome back to 540 AM, 101 FM, WAUK, The Shaw. You're listening to Joel Clayfish, that's me, on Raised in the Shaw. And I'm fairly certain that this radio broadcast is going to become a podcast and become worldwide. Evan, shout out to you in the studio. Kennedy's listening in Waukesha. Thanks for listening, as always. We've got Claiborne Benson with us, the executive director of the Wisconsin Black Historical Society. We went into break. Claiborne's first major career of his life was in the news broadcast industry. Well, newspaper first.
I would say to you, my first real career was shining shoes in my daddy's barbershop. That was my first. When everybody would come in and say to me, "What are you going to do with your life, young man?" Much expectation was put on my head.
And I'd say you delivered.
Well, I don't know, but they clearly, the shining shoes and having conversations with all of these icons coming into my dad's barbershop placed great expectations on my heart that I needed to do something positive.
I bet you heard some great stories. Is that where you learned to storytell?
Listening to my father echo stories about African Americans and civil rights struggles and Africa echo across the walls. I still feel the rhythm of him talking about history as he's talking to everybody in the barbershop. Everybody in the barbershop.
And that never left you, I'm sure.
Oh, no, no, no.
Does that play a large role in how you tell stories today?
It does. It does. Because I tell stories to people all day long in the museum and in public occasions. Yes, it does.
And I find your stories, I could listen to your stories all day long. They're fascinating. And when we went into break, I was going to ask you about the time that you entered television news.
Yes.
Because that was a time of great social unrest and great civil injustice.
1967, 1968, that's the first year in which I started at WTMJ, August 12th, 1968. Young man.
How tough was that?
First of all, I had to learn how to shoot pictures and to tell a story with a camera equipment that I didn't know anything about. They allowed me, through affirmative action, to get this job, working again for $2 an hour, for 13 hours a week, going to school full time. But it was even more tougher when I had an opinion about the civil rights struggle and who we should interview and not interview and what materials they should use on the air. I got into conflicts with people like John McCullough. John McCullough's a big shot. Are you kidding
what,
me?
John McCullough and Melody Wilson.
That's right. They on top of the world.
I grew up watching them and Jerry Taft and Marty Burns Wolf.
And we are fighting, not physically, but arguing in the middle of the newsroom. This young 18, 19-year-old man with an icon like John McCullough over what story should be told.
I don't think people realize how Milwaukee was, in essence, an epicenter of the nation in the civil rights movement.
Very much so. I mean, on two subjects. One, the desegregation of school systems, which was a form of segregation. We saw, and I want to make sure I tell the other story in terms of Father Grappi, but in the desegregation of school systems, we found that in Brown versus the Board of Education, the school system would find themselves with one teacher, one classroom, and good books for all students. Well, that's what we expected. But 4 years later, 1957, they find that they are still segregating against. And black kids are not getting equal education. White kids they're being bused to white schools. White kids come in at 8 o'clock. They go to their lockers and go to the classes of their choice. Black kids come in at 9 o'clock, go to their lockers, and are directed to trailer parks on the back of the playgrounds. Still segregated at the Brown versus Board of Education. It is Lloyd Bobby and Milwaukee's efforts to bring that attention to the United States Supreme Court. And it's the Supreme Court makes the decision to choose Lloyd Bobby to end that segregation policy. Unfortunately, still too few kids are graduating. Still too kids are getting a real education because there are other ways in which people are being denied education. That's a national story. The Supreme Court chose Lloyd Bobby to lead that effort, and he did win. But we lost ultimately because still too few kids are getting it. And then the Father James Grappi issue. All of this is happening at the same time, 1967, 1968. This is a Walter Mondale bill in Congress. He sees segregation as a method to limit the growth of African Americans, bringing them from the South and putting them into clusters. Oh, well, I honestly have to say to you, there are all kinds of clusters, German clusters and Irish clusters, but the difference with African Americans were impoverishment, poverty and poor difficulties. And so Father James Grappi takes his banner up after Martin Luther King actually fails in Chicago. Father James Grappi picks the banner up.
From Milwaukee.
And he marches 200 days and nights. And he comes to Waukesha, New Berlin. He comes to Wauwatosa. He goes everywhere and he does not stop day and night. Lyndon Johnson invites him to testify before Congress. Go to Washington, D.C. And there's still echoes of how eloquently he delivered the message of segregation. Is it still segregated? Yes. It's just gotten a little wider and a little bigger, yet the poverty still does exist. And so, but Milwaukee carried that water for this entire nation, both on education and segregation. Now, the education is the really key thing, because after Plessy versus Ferguson, just after the nation decided that they're going to create a level of segregation, they chose education as to raise and to educate black kids so that they could rise above it and fight segregation policies. Well, it's still segregated, and although we won the laws and the bills, but
You know, something...
It's a struggle.
Very frustrating to me. Something very frustrating to me is when people look at me and they'll say, oh, you know what, racism doesn't exist anymore. It's not, that's a thing of the past. It does. It does. Still exists.
It does.
You know, I served on a task force, on a racial justice task force, mm-hmm. and I'm here to tell you there are different sentencing mm-hmm. for people in certain socioeconomic situations.
Sure.
That still exists today, and there's no question about it.
Yeah.
We're going into this break, but what I'm going to tee up for the next segment, because I think it is so important. I think many people don't understand the magnitude of Wisconsin as a front runner and as the impetus for social justice and social equality in the country. Mm-hmm. We talked about the late 60s, early 70s,
yes.
but it started long before that, during and before the Civil War.
Yes.
And that's the historical yep. part we're going to talk with you about, that you're an expert
right.
in.
Sure.
And we're going to talk about the role of the Underground Railroad in Wisconsin, where it started. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
That was tough to live on.
Yeah,
that.
I know it is.
Welcome back to 540 AM WAUK 101 FM, The Shaw. This is Raised in the Shaw with Joel Clayfish. And our special guest this week, the multi-talented, extremely well-educated and historical Claiborne Benson, who joins us. As I had said in the earlier segment, we've known each other for the better part of three decades. Met each other in television news a million years ago. And Claiborne, you moved from being an award-winning photojournalist into becoming a historian.
I did.
What was the impetus for that move? Why the move from an outstanding career, an exemplary career, into becoming a historian, someone who wants to spread the education of history of the state of Wisconsin?
Oh, you know, I went back to school and I saw all of the employees coming on to TMJ with degrees. And I said, I'm as good as they are. And I have an opportunity, and I'm going to make an opportunity to go back and get my degree. It didn't really make a difference once I got a degree, but a personal satisfaction. But I did go back. I went to UWM and I got my degree in filmmaking and journalism. And then, in the process, I discovered history. I did, as my final project, I did a film about the history of African Americans. And it's on our website, WVHSM. And you can look at it. And I did it, obviously, 35 years ago. But nonetheless, I wanted to tell a story about African Americans in the state of Wisconsin, as from the perspective of a young girl and her grandfather, who takes her all around the state of Wisconsin in various venues and places where they could see real life in Wisconsin, that indeed black people existed and did live in not just in southeastern Wisconsin, but all over the state of Wisconsin. And that's what I did. But here I am. I think it's 50 years later, and I'm still in school. I have gone back for my master's, and I'm a student at UWM at the moment. I love it. I mean, it's not easy. But I'm a history major, and I love it. I mean, I really enjoy the process of learning this information. It gives a certain internal drive that keeps me going.
What was that internal drive that told you or drove you to say that I want to be involved in the Wisconsin Black Historical Society and to make the influences of Black history in Wisconsin known and explored?
I hope I don't influence it. I hope what I do is share it, that information that I've learned. I love learning. There's a adrenaline that flows through my system as I read this material and learn it and process. And I live through the words and the experiences that those people are going through. I process it in my mind. It brings joy to me. So, you know, I'm back at UWM now. I've spent 2 years. I finished up 2 years, and I've got 2 more years. I take one course a semester because I can't take any more, and I love it.
How important is Black history to the state of Wisconsin, back to its origin and founding?
Well, we got election coming up next week. And so the issue of voting for African Americans has always been on the front burner. Joe Oliver is the first to vote. Prior to that, people didn't even consider African Americans. So when was the first African American in the state? Nobody knows. But Joe Oliver is said to be the first citizen. So he votes in 1835. And he is given recognition and given permission to vote. But the consensus is that people don't want African Americans to have the right to vote. And so thus, the issue of voting is, as a state is deciding to be a state in 1846, now the state becomes a state in 1848, but in 1846, as the founding fathers are preparing the state to be a state and putting the guidelines together, they say that African Americans should have the right to vote in 1846. And when they have a vote on the Constitution, the people in the western part of the state said no to that. And so thus, it is taken out of the Constitution. And in 1848, we have our normal election. The state becomes a state. But in 1849, they come back. The African Americans come back to the table and they challenge the system. We have a right to vote, and we need a referendum on the issue of whether or not African Americans should have the right to vote. Now, they voted, and it said that we lost that right to vote in the 1849 referendum. But there's a man by the name of Ezekiel Gillespie in 1866, after the war, Civil War is over, attempts to sue the state of Wisconsin or challenge the system through the courts to take another look at the 1849 referendum vote. And they find, the courts find, that there is a wrong calculation of the 1849 votes. They simply did not calculate those numbers correctly. And they never, even when people write about it today, they smooth over it. They just, they grace it in a nice kind of way. But in truth, the people who calculated those numbers did it wrong. And the courts found it in 1866. And thus, African Americans, the court said that from this point forward, African Americans should always have the right. And we had the right in 1849. From 1849 to 1866, we had that right to vote.
And you brought up the Civil War. You had been talking to me. We had a nice visit a while back. You talked about Wisconsin's role in the Underground Railroad.
Yes.
I'm not sure the average person who lives in this state understands the role Wisconsin played in the Underground Railroad.
Yes.
How important it was and how vast it was.
It was a huge responsibility and the role that they played. For example, I'm just trying to think about how to approach this. So Joshua Glover, well, in 1850, I think I should start there. In 1850, the North is helping runaways make their way to Canada. And the South is saying, we don't like that, because in the United States Constitution, the Underground Railroad, the Fugitive Slave Law is clear that you have a responsibility, Wisconsin, Michigan, Indiana, Pennsylvania, all of the northern states, to return runaways, because it's in the Constitution. It's not a little gesture on the side. It is in the Constitution that the states have a responsibility to return. So in 1850, Henry Clay and John Calhoun get together and they negotiate a new agreement. The South is saying, return our runaways. The North is saying, stop expanding to the West, Oklahoma, Nebraska, Kansas. And both of them agree. So 4 years after 1850, and they've signed and everybody's happy, 4 years after 1850, the state of Wisconsin, Waukesha, none other, find Joshua Glover, who is in jail. He is a runaway. He makes it to Wisconsin. He is in jail, and it said 500 abolitionists break him out of jail and takes him to Canada. 500 of them. Now, what's special about this? We have just violated the United States Constitution, the state of Wisconsin. Now, is Wisconsin the only state that does this? No, but the other ones sneak and do it. The other ones do it when the military is gone. The other ones do it when there's dark. Wisconsin does it to the federal government. We have just broken Joshua Glover out of jail. It brought national attention to every newspaper in the entire country. It's talking about what Wisconsin did in the case of Joshua Glover. It's one of the things that hurried the Civil War into place.
And that was in, where was he being captive? Where was he captive?
He was being caught in Milwaukee. He's broken out of jail. He's taken to Deacon Brown's farm on Fond du Lac Avenue, then brought here to Waukesha. I hid out in Waukesha for a while, and then taken down to Burlington, Wisconsin, where he's hid out in the Burlington area.
Was Waukesha, the Waukesha Freeman was the paper, was one of the earlier papers.
Waukesha and the men who ran the Freeman, and that's significant in itself, Freeman, because they were abolitionists, and Waukesha is like the driving force to continue this Underground Railroad. Waukesha is the impetus to make Underground Railroad real. And it's Waukesha that provides the conductors for the Underground Railroad. It's Waukesha that schedules the ships that come into the harbor to take people out. It's Waukesha to provide a hiding out and food for the various Underground Railroad people. They come up two ways. One, they're coming up through Burlington into the Waukesha area, and they're coming up along the lakefront from Kenosha to Racine. Milwaukee's not such a friendly place, but then they go to these various ports, and they take these ships to Canada. And the most popular of the places in Canada was a place called Sandwich, Canada. Now, we celebrate two of them. One, Caroline Qualls, who comes in 43 or 42, and then we celebrate Joshua Glover, that brings a national attention to Milwaukee as a result of him being broken out.
So I don't know that the average person knows how influential the city of Waukesha was in the Underground Railroad at the time. And this is nothing that would have gone without consequence were people caught aiding and abetting the folks who were making their way through Waukesha to Canada. You hear, you know, that the Waukesha Freeman actually had, there were messages laden into the copy of the Waukesha Freeman. Is that has that become folklore?
No, it's true, and it's the editors of and I should have brought one of their, but I'm going to make sure that you get a copy of one of the editors who talks about his role. He was at the Joshua Glover being broken out of jail, and he becomes the editor of the Waukesha Freeman. But honestly, when and I'm putting less emphasis than I should, but the name Freeman clearly was a philosophy of the citizens of Waukesha, that we don't want fugitive slaves to be enslaved. We want to break them out of jail. And the churches over by the Fox River is the primary places in which they were hid out. The Fox River led right down into Burlington area.
Huh. And some of the boats were right on the Fox River that were taking slaves to freedom.
Yes, it was.
Isn't that something?
All the way down into Racine.
And just that quick, we've only got one segment left, Claiborne Benson.
Okay, thank you.
And we're going to come back with Claiborne Benson on 540 AM.
Kershaw.
WAUK. We're going to talk about Kershaw, North Dakota. You said
South Carolina.
Yes, all right. We'll be back on Raised in the Shaw. I'm your host, Joel Clayfish, along with Claiborne Benson. And we're going to talk about some of the other things you can experience in the Wisconsin Black Historical Society. Coming up.
Yeah.
I mean, so yeah. It's a mixed message there. That's cool.
Blame it all on my roots. I showed up in boots. Ruined your black tie fair.
Oh, I think that's Garth Brooks there, isn't it, Evan? Yeah. Blame it all on my roots, he says. Well, we are talking about roots. Today we're talking about the roots of Wisconsin. And we're with Claiborne Benson on Raised in the Shaw with your host, Joel Clayfish. That's me. And we're talking about the fascinating history of Waukesha, Wisconsin. And we went into the last break talking about its part it played in the Underground Railroad and the importance of free people at the time. And, you know, we talked during break for a second about the motives of the abolitionists who were risking, in many cases, their lives to be part of this. And Claiborne, you were telling me that there were many different motives for those who had set up the Underground Railroad and who were making it happen in Waukesha and throughout Wisconsin. And
can you believe that many of the Europeans, even before they left Europe, knew that they were going to be abolitionists and came to Wisconsin? And our population really began to grow when the Erie Canal began to open up and Europeans began to flow through the Erie Canal and make it into Lake Michigan and set up. There's one guy by the name of Goodrich, and he brings with him, although you only hear his name. He is in Milton, Wisconsin, and he creates the Milton House, which is a stagecoach, 1845, early 1850s, which is a stagecoach hotel. And many great people spend time in that hotel, but he is also setting up an underground tunnel that leads from one building to another building. In case the police or the military comes, the stagecoaches come in, and back of the stagecoaches are these people of color, and they get out of the coach, they get something to eat, and they go into the basement where they hide out while the military people come in and search. And
so there were some real clandestine type things here, underground tunnels, false walls in homes you were telling me about.
More than that, they set policies. The churches set policies on what you can do, even with their members. If you are going to be anti-abolitionist, you cannot be in this church. You are discommunicated completely. And of course, Baptist, Presbyterian, Congregational, everything except the Catholic Church are really engaged and involved, and they take it very seriously, and they write about it. There's a book called Abolitionists that is out that is very, very good, that talks about religious commitment. But then there's Free Soilers. The farmers did not like the fact that that they had to compete against the southern states with their crops, and all they had was cousins, next door neighbors, and nephews, and sons and daughters to harvest their crop. They didn't like that, and so that they were political reasons. The Republican Party was anti-slavery, and so that So that was another very important reasons not to do it. So yeah, they had motivation. I mean, these are my own philosophies, but clearly, and even the descendants who lived in Milwaukee or lived in the state of Wisconsin, and their ancestors tell them, because we were slaves in Europe, we do not want to further and support the idea of slavery of anybody. And so they did not stop. They did not want slavery to continue, and they fought in every possible way. You should take a look at the number of people who enlisted into the service when the Civil War started from Wisconsin. Lots of them. Mm-hmm. Lots of them for political reasons as well. Lots of them. In 1861, 1860, they enlisted in great numbers. So we're going to talk about Kershaw yet?
Yeah, go ahead. you noticed that I have a Kershaw Knives shirt on today, and you were saying Kershaw.
So now, I thank you for allowing me to do that. When I graduated from UWM with my undergrad degree, the second most important thing was to find out who I was. And I needed to do that. My name is Claiborne Benson III, but I knew nothing about the first or the second. Nothing. Absolutely didn't know where they came from or nothing. And so when I saw you with Kershaw, that is a county next to where I eventually found that I had two sisters and where my father was a father and grandfather were enslaved during their period of a little small town in Lancaster, South Carolina, and there's a little city called Liberty Hill. Now, Liberty Hill was back in the woods, up in a little mountain, and the Catawba River serviced that little community. Now, if you want to talk about a Southern lifestyle, Liberty Hill was Southern lifestyle. I mean, clearly it was the Topa paradise for white people. Excuse me for saying that, white listeners. It really was the place where they enjoyed slavery in its truest form. But I saw, through my visualization, I saw my great-grandfather harvest cotton and load it onto a barge that goes down to Charleston where they sold it. I saw my great-great-grandfather is in church at 16 years old and sitting in the balcony because I see it on ledgers and I see it in books and such. I'm even able to trace my ancestors back to Charleston, South Carolina, coming from Cameroon, coming into Charleston, South Carolina in 1810, and is hired by James Howe. Howe is the name of the white owner, and he was he owned a company along the coast of South Carolina, in Charleston, South Carolina, where they carved the names and images on stones that went in the back of churches. That is what my ancestors did in his earliest days when we first got to America. I clearly can see those things in my mind.
I'm certain that your family's history is part of the reason you are as involved in the Black Historical Society as you are.
It gives me purpose.
Oh, I can't imagine how much. What a phenomenal hour, and that's how fast it's gone. We've got 1 minute left. I want you to tell folks why they should see the Wisconsin Black Historical Society and give us a website before we go off air.
Thank you. The website is WBHSM, Wisconsin Black Historical Society Museum. And we are located in Milwaukee, 26th and Center. And telephone number is 414-372-7677. We focus on Wisconsin's histories, clearly. We try to stay local, and we try to talk about the things that affect African Americans in Wisconsin.
Claiborne Benson, it's been a real pleasure.
As well.
Thank you. We'll see you next week, folks.
Thank you. Bye.